Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Mecca Nagel. Nagel is a professor of philosophy at SUNY Cortland and a senior visiting fellow at the Institute of African Development at Cornell University. She's the co-editor with Seth Azuma of Prisons and Punishment, Reconsidering Global Penality, published by Africa World Press in 2007. Welcome to the show, Mecca.
Thank you so much for having me, Tish.
Now, you've been involved with prison issues and prison reform for a good number of years now. Right. What is it that brought this issue to your attention?
Right. I came to Cortland and upstate New York in 1999 from Minnesota, where I taught in women's studies. And already then I was starting to begin to have an interest in prisons, but actually really in alternatives to imprisonment and mediation. And when I came to Cortland and, you know, New York, I was struck by the proliferation of prisons. It seemed to me that there's more prisons in the vicinity of Cortland if you go any 50 miles in any direction than colleges and institutions for higher learning. My colleague Larry Ashley and I started going to some prisons, and he had the conviction, still has, that SUNY, State University of New York, where I'm employed, has as its mission statement to educate its citizenry. And so we thought we shouldn't stop in front of the prison walls, but figure out an ambitious project to bring education to the prisoners themselves through distance learning technology. So we, in fact, went to a number of prisons nearby and check that out. In the end, the project didn't come to fruition because we really did not have any luck getting grant money for it, because it seemed not to be that useful to the grantors, as it were, to fund education for adult men, who is our primary population here in this region. And that's quite unfortunate, but then I decided to go into the prisons myself and start teaching philosophy.
Yeah, I know you've been doing that for a good number of years. Right. Now, let's set the stage in regard to prisons. Right. Recent articles, New York Times and elsewhere, one in 100 American adults are in prison now.
Right.
Talk to us about the massive waste in some ways a lot of this is.
Yeah, it's really intriguing and unfortunate and puzzling to criminologists and philosophers who deal with prison issues that at times when we can really see that crime on so many levels is going down, that increasingly people are incarcerated, not only arrested, but sentenced to long periods of time. And so that the U.S. now has become the prison nation of the world, imprisoning more of its percentage of its citizens than any other nations, including the so-called rogue nations of the world. So this is something of grave concern, in particular also given the racialization of the imprisonment. So you have African Americans who are maybe about 13% of the populace make up about 40% of the prison population.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a stark discrepancy. And what we know for sure, many people have written about that, is that there's an overcriminalization, there's an over-policing of people of color, in particular of black people, but also Latinos, and I must also add Native Americans, who tend not to be foregrounded that much because they're only 1% of the population, but percentage-wise, they have dramatic...
A lot of the African-American communities especially have been decimated in regard to the male population. Mm-hmm. The statistic I had is 1 in 9 black men between 20 and 34 are imprisoned in this country.
Right, and even further problematic, 1 in 3 black men can face imprisonment in their lifetime. Yeah, I just heard, I gave a talk on my concept of prisons as diaspora, as new diasporic sites, and a respondent in the audience, participant said that she had this very sad anecdote of asking a young black boy, a 5-year-old, so what do you want to do when you grow up? And he said to her, well, with earnesty, you know, and seriousness, well, I want to go to college, right? But before that, I'm going to prison in order to get that behind me.
Oh, yeah? My goodness.
So you see the incredible social psychic costs of this prisonation and how it envelops the black psyche in particular is really troubling.
It has really become a prison culture.
Yes, indeed.
And now, would you define some of the many prisoners in this country as political prisoners nowadays?
Right. That's always a controversial question in prison reform circles and abolitionist circles. Who counts as political prisoner? That is somebody who is sentenced because of their political beliefs. And in our book, Sophia Elijah, who is an attorney for political prisoners, mentions the fact that President Clinton, on his last day in office, pardoned some 11 Puerto Rican prisoners, right? Prisoners of war, as it were, because they don't think they are Americans. Mm. Puerto Rico is an independent nation, right? And he came as close, as she says in her essay, as recognizing these 11 men and women as political prisoners sentenced for their beliefs in the freedom and independence of Puerto Rico, right? But this government does not believe it. Incarcerates anybody for their political beliefs.
But that was bandied about so much in the 60s. George Jackson, Angela Davis. There was a whole culture of people who said, indeed, these are political prisoners.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, George Jackson and others, would say that not only those people who are convicted for political beliefs, but also those who come in because of social circumstances, right? So the so-called social or common criminal petty thief, if not, or violent criminal, may also be considered political prisoners, precisely because the environment creates conditions that criminality is really the only choice, right? Or becoming, as the jargon of the 60s were, an illegitimate capitalist, right?
I remember some of that. Yeah. Now, we don't hear that much about women in prison, and so many women are put in prison for nonviolent crimes, drug addiction, prostitution. Talk to us a little bit about how that has affected our culture.
Yeah, it used to be women were about 3 or 6% of the prison population. It's again, the U.S. is quite stark in contrast to other nations by over-incarcerating its women, women citizens, to up to 9%. And in fact, when you look at recent demographic patterns, it is women of color, in particular black women, who've been rounded up and imprisoned because of the war on drugs. Yeah, so that it is women who tend to be the fall people for, say, the partners, male partners they're with in a sting operation. So he says, well, my partner did it because he thinks maybe because she's a woman, she's going to get a lighter deal, where she may not be involved at all, but may face, in this state, a penalty of 15 to life. Because of the Rockefeller drug laws. Mm-hmm. And my hope is, given that we now have a governor who has confessed to illicit drug use, that in fact we will, under this Democratic leadership, do away with the Rockefeller drug laws.
Yeah, those have been actually, this is like the early days of draconian.
Right, three strikes, you're out, those kinds of policies.
California,
It's really set the stage for that, what Rockefeller did in the 70s.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the idea that you were trying to go into prisons.
Right.
To do some educating,
right.
And the grantees wouldn't give them. What about that old idea of rehabilitation? Did you argue with him about that?
Well, see, the grantors. Well, the issue is really a complex psychological one as well.
Because, on the part of the people who said no, right?
Yeah, right. Because this worry, how I know George Soros, Open Society, set something up, a pilot project in Attica, right? And they told us they wanted to see how that went. And I didn't hear anything afterwards, so I'm not sure how successful it was. But it's really difficult convincing the powers that be, the various program directors of educational programs in the prisons and the wardens and the guards that this would be a good thing, right? So there's a lot of pressures to shut down these prison education programs. And at the time after 9/11, when I was teaching, there was always code orange that I was driving 50 miles to the prison and code orange hit and I was returning home without having taught, right? So there's all these external impediments put in place that makes it very difficult to deliver a successful educational program. That having said, there are good folks in the state who are doing comprehensive education. The Bard College, I believe, has an initiative. And so there are a few men and some women who are getting still to this day a Bachelor of Arts or of Science or graduating from theological seminary. Yeah, but it's just too few. And with the Omnibus Crime Bill of the mid-90s passed by Congress, rehabilitation and education were pretty much sunk. Yeah, and it makes no sense from a utilitarian perspective, because we know that, and one writer, a former prisoner, Jojo Alperin, writes about that, that education is the one meaningful force of habilitation, as he calls it, because he says, how can we talk about rehabilitation when we haven't been habilitated at first?
Yeah. Right. Do you think that there's some kind of unconscious thought on the part of these people who are resisting education, that an educated populace is less passive?
Right. That could be a concern, right? Because there is something to keeping an unemployment rates down, for instance, by having over 2 million people in prisons and another 5 million waiting to be imprisoned. That is people who are on probation and parole, right? So we're talking about at least in any given year, really, of 11 million plus people involved in the criminal justice system on the receiving end, right? But it's also a burgeoning industry. You have lots of personnel involved. We see that now recently with the outcry over the closures of, you know, Camp Versalia, a minimum security prison that I also visited. I mean, it's unfortunate in a way that there's a drive to close minimum security prisons when you have plenty of maximum security prisons that need to be looked at and seen. You know, if all these folks who are incarcerated, for instance, under Rockefeller drug laws for nonviolent felonies, right? Whether it's really worth putting them in Attica, in Elmira, in Auburn.
And especially in regard to cost as well.
Right.
Well, one of those statistics that have come out recently is the fact that many states spend more money on corrections than they do on higher education,
right,
just in the general population.
Yeah. Right.
So there probably is a movement to keep these prison cultures alive and well for that reason as well.
Yeah, and we've seen some folks have commented on that since the implementation of the Rockefeller drug laws, we have definitely seen an inverse relationship of the drop of public education monies to higher education and a rise of prison construction. And under Governor Cuomo, using HUD money, I mean, funneling it through strange mechanisms so that the population at large wouldn't have to vote for prison construction, right? So we see now, being at Cortland, we kind of joke that we're just publicly assisted college, but not really a public university anymore.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the juvenile justice system, too, because a century ago, the premise was that these children, you know, were less culpable and could be rehabilitated. Now, what are we seeing?
Well, there's, again, hopeful signs. There's a bill I was just supporting this morning to close down several juvenile jails in this state that have 10 or fewer residents. Really, we're talking about children being jailed. Millions would be saved, right? You know, if you talk about a cost-benefit analysis. Of course, I, as a philosopher, also want to talk about the humanity involved and does it really make sense for society to incarcerate its children from tender age of 12 on? I just returned from Germany. There was a huge debate over, you know, a conservative politician in the midst of election campaigning suggested we need to go after the 12-year-olds. And he was focusing particularly on the Turks, right? Turkish youngsters. Immediately, very thoughtful groups came forward and said, this is insane. We cannot allow our 12-year-olds to be incarcerated, right? So 14-year-old is the threshold in Germany. But, you know, we're still awaiting to have that kind of meaningful debate in this country, you know, where in cases when you have an 11-year-old shooting classmates, that there's a cry for the death penalty or certainly life in prison. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mecca Nagel. She's the co-editor of the book Prisons and Punishment, Reconsidering Global Penality. Let's talk a little bit more about children in prison. Mm-hmm. Are more children statistically committing violent crimes, and is that the premise on which many more children are being tried as adults?
Yeah, there was, in the mid-90s, there was this whole syndrome or this hype of the child predator, and I think the public thought of the young black male again, right, as the super predator, as actually they were labeled, right? And one could argue that Ritalin and various other forms of psychotropic legal drugs are having an effect, a disciplining effect on the young population, that some of them are on a massive regimen of drugs at the tender age of six, right? And we don't know yet about all the side effects of these drugs, right? But they were, this was actually, it goes back to an so-called violence or anti-violence initiative of, I believe, Mr. Goodwin. He was the head of the Institute of Health in the 80s, 1980s. Mm. And he suggested, you know, maybe we can just get rid of all these delinquent youth, incarcerating them when they're young men, if we drug them at early age. And back then, the Black Congressional Caucus said, oh, this is racism, this is terrible. And look where we are 20 years later, right? Ritalin is the drug of choice, or Prozac, or what have you. Mm-hmm. Right?
Is there more of an effort to rehabilitate young children, say, under 25, than some of the adults that are considered hardened? And
yeah, there's certainly lip service paid to that. I know I've been associated with the Community Advisory Board of McCormick Secure Center, which is a maximum secure prison, really, for young boys here south of Ithaca. Mm. And there's very good efforts of introducing meaningful educational programs. Yeah, so the board tries very hard to change the young men's lives around, and also focus on reentry programs, right? Because it's not enough to work with them while they're incarcerated, but also help them once they get back on the streets, so to speak, to keep their head high and not rejoin gangs, their kinship, formations of choice, what have you, mm-hmm. and fall in those mm-hmm. patterns again, right?
I would think young children who get in trouble and do end up in prison need role models.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely.
That's right. But if you look at some studies that the Sentencing Project has done under Mark Maurer, it's very clear that there is an incredible bias. So we can't talk about the youth at large. We have to talk about class and race issues again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so 14-year-old white boy who was meddling with cocaine or crack, right, who is from a middle-class background, if he's standing arraigned in front of the judge, right, there will be immediately support services made available. This is not a boy who's going into a foster home or, worse, residential home, a prison, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Well, but folks who are, kids who are poor, who are black, Latino, they don't usually have that kind of kind spirit, that white kids face in the court, right? So there's a way, sort of a cynical attitude, So here I come back to that five-year-old boy who just imagined himself as the society's predator and who must be imprisoned, just because he's black.
And to get it out of his system so then he can go to college.
Right.
So that is really the saddest thing I've heard in a long time.
Yeah.
Wow. Indeed. Now, how do you, as a reformer of prisons, mm-hmm. which you are, obviously, mm-hmm. how are you going to change the mentality? I mean, so many small towns, medium-sized towns, are dependent on prisons for their vibrancy.
Right. Well, I've been involved in efforts both here in Ithaca and in Cortland, where I live, in creating momentum to close or at least not expand, the local jails. And it has been somewhat successful in Ithaca. I'm not sure if we have the momentum in Cortland yet to say that we don't need to have more jail cells for people.
What do you offer as the alternative, though? Because people are going to say people have to be locked up.
Yeah, but if you look at, in particular, the jails, Tish, is when you visit the jails, 70% or at least over 50% are people who are there on remand, who are remand prisoners prior to conviction, prior to trial. Right, and there's something really somewhat obscene, in a legal system that suggests that rich people who can afford bail, will find themselves in their safe homes, you know, awaiting trial, whereas the poor who don't make bail, right, or are then considered a flight risk because of lack of social ties, right, lack of, you know, brilliant lawyers surrounding them, you know, they languish in prison, you know, and then are out of a job, right, and stigmatized, and so forth.
I think a lot of people don't realize that there really are people who cannot make bail.
Yeah,
I think most people think, oh, you know. Yeah. Bail's available. Nobody has to sit in prison and await, you know, justice.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
So I basically I start small, you know, but then I teach in SUNY Cortland course that Larry Ashley and I designed on prisons and punishment after model after the book, right? And so I want to also influence the young criminologists, you know, who want to be state troopers and police and prison guards to think about the humanity of the people that they're guarding and then that they're arresting, right? And think about the prison system at large, you know, how it functions in the society or how it malfunctions in the society, right? So it's, you know, those kind of small steps that I do take. And then in my own writing, it's actually less so about reform than about abolition. Yeah, that yes, reforms are nice, you know, tinkering with the system, but we really need to look at, and this is along the lines of Angela Davis, who you mentioned earlier, very 60s in mentality.
She is still speaking out. She is still absolutely part of our culture.
Exactly.
And an incredible professor at Santa Cruz.
Exactly. Molding young minds and sending them out to be professors, radical professors across the nation as well. But yeah, she's also an unusual, being a distinguished scholar and distinguished chair in her institution in Santa Cruz, for being still involved in movement politics. And this time it's Critical Resistance, which is one of the leading abolitionist groups in this country. And so it's mapping our strategy along this anti-slavery movement, because as you know, it was the black people themselves that had a much more radical perspective, whereas the white abolitionists thought, you know, well, maybe we should just work towards gradual abolition of slavery, right? So that maybe the future generation should be freed, but not the current one, And then it was really the radical abolitionists who won out, you know, and the 13th Amendment is a consequence of that. In part, but 13th Amendment, of course, is another demon of sorts because it basically codified slavery in the prison system, right? So you set the slaves free at the same time you lock them up under liberal proceduralism. Well, if you're guilty of a crime, you know, then you can be treated as a slave of the state.
Once again.
Yeah, 1865.
Now, you've studied prison systems all over the world. Are there any states, nation states, that don't imprison people or imprison very few, only for certain crimes?
Well, not imprisoning nation states, that's the magic word here. there's not none to my knowledge, right? But indigenous people, if you have a Maasai, for instance, in Kenya, right, who is accused of something, right, and is hurled in front of the crown of I don't think they call it crown anymore. It's colonialism is still alive and well in Kenya, but the crown is a Canadian thing. So if they go in front of a conventional British educated police force, if the elders find out that their person, you know, a Maasai is about to be put into Kenyan jail, all hell sort of breaks loose, and there's a concerted effort to bring this person back and say, no, we are doing it our so-called tribal way, our Maasai way, to adjudicate. And it usually is for the Maasai at this point, because they don't believe in the death penalty or any other harsher crimes, punishments rather. It is in form of restitution. You will have to give up, you know, if you're accused of stealing something, you'll have to give up a good portion of your cattle, say, if you're involved in the Maasai way of living, right? I found that in my studies that restitution is a much more convincing way for most people, and especially victims, people who have been victimized by somebody, than this whole abstract notion of doing time in some foreign prison cell. where people languish and think about worse crimes that they could do when they get out.
And just try to survive. And survival sometimes does entail learning how to be sneaky and violent.
Yes,
and
that's right.
And get somebody before they get you.
Right. And so the ironic thing about the modern imprisonment is, as you know, the Quakers had wonderfully conjured up in this country, the birth of the prison, is reforming the soul, you know, doing penitence in the monastic cell, if you will, with a good book, with the Bible. Immediately after they started up this project, they came to realize that prisons are nothing but crime schools. This is where you perfect your criminality, if you already had a disposition towards that. And so we are working with a 200-year-old moribund project, you know, futile project that is not getting us anywhere. But there are other nations, like Mali, I visited, that do not incarcerate people in the dimensions that we see in the West, and now increasingly in Europe as well. 40, maybe 30 people per 100,000 are incarcerated, as opposed to the 5,000 Native Americans in 100,000 who find themselves incarcerated.
It's just a system that just eats itself alive from the inside, Now, in the introduction to your book, Hal Pepinski, I guess you say his name, he calls the prison system a criminal control industrial complex. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah.
And that's indeed what it has become.
Right. Yeah, Hal Pepinski wrote the foreword, actually, of this book, and he's a leading voice of the critical criminologists for peace. So he's really turning the profession inside out, as it were.
Now, we only have a couple minutes left. I understand. Are you doing research about African prison intellectuals? Have you finished that? Is that going to become a book?
Well, I have just published last week an article on a few prison intellectuals that I singled out from Mali, from Kenya, and from South Africa. But I'm still working on what I proposed in my sabbatical project last year, on a concerted effort to look at prison intellectuals in South Africa and how they envision a democratic society post-apartheid.
Now, are these is intellectual a kind of a code word for political prisoners?
Well, indeed. So, you know, it really comes out of the Gramscian organic intellectual description, certainly for South Africa fighting apartheid. Yeah, you had thousands of people in prison for their political convictions, no doubt.
Indeed. And then can you share with us in the minute that we have left about what you found out about some of these intellectuals and their plans?
Right. Well, so, some of them have, for instance, given up arms or the armed struggle and are really going back to traditional ways of, with respect to criminal justice issues, sorting out crime in traditional forms of restitution, say. Some of them, more leaning towards the vindictive way of saying, well, you may have to set an example in order to deter others from committing a crime, but it would not involve imprisonment. So Robben Island should be closed and should continue to be a museum.
And what about civil disobedience? Is that part of the menu?
Yeah, sure. And because we've seen certainly the way Mandela and Mbeki government have said social policy, have promised, land reform, what have you, and it has not materialized for the masses of people. And we also see an epidemic of violence across the country.
Well, Mecca Nagel, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for talking to us about this very important subject.
Thank you for having me, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.